the Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Claff for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Claff. This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
Can't say that too many times. This is Stan Claff. I have in the studio with me Natalie Solomon, my co-conspirator, and I have with me also Tabu, who's busy working the numbers, the digits, the dials, whatever it is. And we have as a guest tonight Judith Anser, clinical psychologist in practice in Johannesburg. And if you want to participate in this discussion in any way, you can telegram us on 061-895-1019 or SMS 34519. Judith, welcome.
Thank you.
And Judith, I just want to set the scene. So tonight we're going to be talking about one of your specialities, or maybe it's your speciality, gender and sexual orientation, all to do with gender identity and sexuality, etc. And started off by playing a song which poet laureate Bob Dylan says, don't criticize what you can't understand. So tonight is really a search for education. What don't we understand? Yeah. What do we understand? And can you shed some light on this, which I'm sure is a very complex field and very intriguing for most of us. Most of us probably know very little.
Yes, I mean, I think that song was absolutely apt and a brilliant summary, actually, of the challenges that face parents, I think especially fathers and grandfathers, dealing with kids and teenagers who are behaving and maybe expressing themselves in ways that even in 1964 when Bob Dylan wrote the song were not as foregrounded or as prominent or as kind of culturally in the middle classes certainly acceptable.
Yes, and I mean, the world is changing so rapidly in all aspects, and there's new language coming into the way we speak and the way we talk and the way we describe things. I mean, kids are growing up in a completely different world, and and they have to deal with it, and probably they know a lot about or are more tolerant of dealing with it than some of us who go back to 1964.
I do think that kids often take the lead. And I do think when I do some of these talks around gender and sexuality and identity, and I do them sometimes for kids, but often for teachers and for parents. And the truth is that we as parents and teachers and educators are behind where the kids are. The kids are, they know all the lingo. We don't. And it is, and I appreciate that it's a contentious issue because it touches on kind of really strongly held beliefs and ideas and views about what is acceptable, what is normal, what is moral, what is okay. And I think my take on it is I'm not in a position to address issues of belief or faith. That's not my domain. I'm here to really talk about what the best science tells us about how kids are developing, about how gender and sexual orientation evolves, where it comes from. And I know that's hard for some people, so I do really understand that it's a challenging topic to address.
So you started off with using the word continuum. You said that sexual orientation ranges along a continuum, which indicates that sexual attraction can be exclusive to the opposite sex, or exclusive to the same sex, and I suppose a whole range in between. And so it's no more binary. I mean, that's a word that's crept in of late, and I hear it all, and I mean, that's a computer term, which is either or, there's no in between, and there's no more binary in anything today.
Absolutely, and I think it's not just sexual orientation or desire that we understand now to be on a continuum. And in fact, this has been around, this idea of the continuum has been studied scientifically or in terms of research for a long time. The pioneering work on it was done by a very eccentric scientist called Alfred Kinsey. And he was the person who said, well, actually, firstly, what people say they do in bed and what they really do are often two very different things. And he was the person who said that while there are many people who might be on either end of the continuum, there are many people who, whose desire, is directed in different ways. And I think the same is true, we're discovering about gender as well, that it's very hard actually to understand that gender is not simply about male and female, but that there is actually a continuum of gender expression or experience as well. And when I was thinking about this discussion, I thought, if you indulge me for a minute, that if we think about an issue that really tells people about how complicated gender is, whether you are a man. So what I just want to go back a moment is to say, what I tell people is that your sexuality, your sexual orientation is who you are attracted to, who you desire, who you want to be with. Your gender identity is who you feel you are. That's got very little actually to do with your sexual orientation. So does that make sense that they're two different issues we're dealing with?
And Judith, would you say that those things are fluid, or are those fixed orientations or identities, or is that something that changes along the course of one's life?
So I think that, again, there's a continuum. I say this in a way that means I don't have to ever give a yes or no answer. So there isn't a binary in that either, is that it is for some people, it feels pretty fixed. So some people are born, and the terminology used in the kind of literature today is some people are assigned female at birth because they look like they're female, they look like a little girl, and that feels like a pretty fixed, stable sense of self. But for some people, it's not so fixed. For some people, it's more fluid. And the same with sexual orientation. Some people, and the question people often ask is, how do people know that they're gay? The same way people know that they're straight. It's a kind of a feeling. And for some people, there's a fluid movement between different states of desire or different senses of self. And for some people, it's pretty fixed. And I think maybe life is easier when you do know who you are when you're little. And of course, because society is constructed around the binary, it's harder when you're not either or, when you're not, and when you grow up with a sense of being different from whom other people think you are. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
Well, actually, there's a gray area in all of that, because I think that as people grow up, as youngsters grow up, they start to realize that they're not normal. When they say normal, they're not either male or female in the sense of what everybody else considers. And that surely is leading to a lot of unhappiness. From alcohol abuse to depression, meeting all the diagnostic criteria for depression, mood disorders, and even thinking about suicide, because of the fact that they don't know, and there's no guidance per se at a point. I suppose somebody's going to ultimately recognize the issue, but is there a way to guide you along these lines? How do you obviate all of that? How do you diagnose it?
So I'm going to step back a bit, because I think the issue of mental health and identity and our gender and sexuality is complicated. But to illustrate how hard it is sometimes to know what's going on, I want to tell you a little bit about something that used to be called intersex conditions. And those are now called by the pediatricians disorders of sexual differentiation. And that happens when infants are born, and at birth, there's a lack of clarity about their sex organs, about their genitalia. They used to call those kids hermaphrodites. That's really an inaccurate term, because they don't have both. But what's happened is, in utero, for whatever reason, there might be a genetic cause or hormonal causes, but doctors are not always sure of why, the baby is born and there's a lack of certainty. And our most famous intersex person in South Africa, or person with disorder of sexual differentiation, is Caster Semenya. And we know the controversies about that. But what we know also, and some kids or some people don't even get that condition diagnosed until there may be an issue, let's say, with girls not starting to get their periods. They don't start to menstruate, so they start being investigated. Now, they look like a girl on the outside. They feel like a girl. They've been raised as a girl. But they go see the doctor, and what they find is that there may not be all the female reproductive organs. And there are multiple variants of these disorders of sexual differentiation. And the thing that's really complicated, because people often say, well, just look at the chromosomes. Don't your chromosomes tell you if you're a boy or a girl? Because if you're XX, you're a girl. If you're XY, you're a male. But it doesn't work like that. There's no actual correlation in these children and in the people whose gender doesn't feel matched to the one they were assigned at birth. There isn't. You can't look at the chromosomes. They don't tell us enough. You can't even look at the hormones, because there are many, many women whose natural testosterone may be higher than some men. And I think the analogy that I once read is that on the color continuum, we don't know where sort of orange becomes red or where yellow becomes orange. There's a point on that continuum. And in the same way, it's unclear actually to the medical professionals where boys and girls start differentiating. And this disorder of sexual differentiation, which is purely a biological disorder, tells us how complicated the issue of gender and gender identity is. So more and more, you were saying that growing up feeling different, that in itself is a cause of psychological distress. And of course, if you feel different and you're told by your society that you're not acceptable for feeling different, that causes even more distress. And what researchers have come to is that there doesn't seem to be any evidence that people who are gay, who are homosexual, or people who have gender dysphoria have any higher rates of psychiatric disorders as a result of their sexual orientation or their gender, but that the rates of psychological or psychiatric distress are really related to internalized stigma and growing up in societies that tell you that you're not okay. And that is where you get the high rates of depression, substance use, etc.
So it's around a sense of being misunderstood and a sense of terrible isolation and a lack of support, and often having to live a life underground rather than really bringing it to the light and making sense and connection with others. What would be best practice then? What would you suggest would be a better alternative so that we evade those kinds of mental suffering?
So, I mean, at the risk of sounding like I'm just flattering the people who've invited me to speak, but this kind of talk show, this kind of information that goes out to the broader community is a start. It's really important. Mm-hmm. So to start with, as Stan said, the education. Mm-hmm. To start also, I think if parents, especially those who feel very uncomfortable about this topic, if they can just stop and think about how much the world is changing, and I suppose for schools, for communities, for parents, to have a sense of humility about what we don't understand, but also to feel okay that to know that the most important thing we can ever give our children is a sense that they are loved and that they are accepted. And Natalie, you'll know really well the work of Thomas Bowlby, who spoke a lot about the importance of love and attachment in terms of growing happy, healthy children. Absolutely. And he said, what all children need is for their parents and their homes, their caregivers and their communities, I would say as well, to be both what we call secure bases and safe havens. So what parents give children is a secure base from which they can leave. So if you have a secure base, you know who you are, you feel accepted in that base, and you can go out into the world. And when the world is difficult, when kids are not nice to you, when life brings you disappointment, you go back to those caregivers, to those people who love you, to your family, and they are your safe haven. And that's where, if parents are aware that their child is not dressing according to the kind of boys wear this and girls wear that, the best thing they can do is firstly to pause and not panic, but also to not use language that stigmatizes the children, to use terms like, oh, that's not what real boys do, and don't be a sissy. Children are so sensitive to the way their parents speak about them and about other people. So I think if parents, as a start, think that their primary job is to love their children, that will, I think, go a long way to helping children feel safe when they have to tell their parents difficult things. So, yeah.
Okay, just to, if anybody wants to call in or send a telegram rather, 061-895-1019 or SMS us on 34519. And, we're talking to Judith Anser, a clinical psychologist. We have in the studio Dr. Natalie Solomon, who I should have mentioned is also a psychologist. We have Thabo Mlengeni, who's running the show for us and making sure you can hear us and hear our mellifluous tones and helping us with the technical side of things. And my name is Stan Claff. I'm from the Hebrew Order of David. And we are exploring all the situations around sexual identity, sexual orientation, etc. And I wanted to just ask you a question. It's really around Hollywood. So Hollywood is glorifying homosexuality. It's in every film, in every series. You see it. It's sort of almost to the point of it being a fad, socially acceptable at that level. Is this helping or is it hindering?
Is it really glorifying or is it just really representing more openly?
I think it's glorifying it in a sense. A lot of films have been made about it. A lot of discussion around it. It's sort of pulling it into the mainstream.
Well, so I'm with Natalie on this. I think that it's about making what has always been there from time immemorial. There have been people whose genders are not binary, and there have been people who are homosexual and bisexual. And I think that what mainstream media and Hollywood and Netflix and wherever, I think that what they are doing is creating a more accurate and greater representation of gay people and of gender non-binary or non-variant people. I think that there is a concern. I hear this from parents and sometimes from teachers that it's a fad and it will all pass. I also think that we don't know how much was there because people were under such pressure to hide their true identities before.
Did you see a show recently called Gentleman Jack, which was about a lady who 200 years ago, she was in the English aristocracy and she was seducing all the aristocracy's wives. Things were going on behind the scenes.
It's based on true story. It's based on the diaries of a woman at that time who kept a diary. And of course, you know, it's a very interesting series. I did actually watch it. But what I was going to say is that a lot of people get confused about the nature, like, of choice. Because they'll think that, well, being gay is a choice, but it's not a choice any more than being straight is a choice. The best research, and I've really looked into this carefully because I don't want to be accused of not representing the science properly. The best research that we have is that people are, as Lady Gaga said, born this way. That being gay or being bisexual or being heterosexual is something you are born. It's not something you are made by your society. So there used to be a belief that if you had a certain kind of parent, if you had a domineering mother, that was the one cliche, or if you had an absent father, then as a boy, you may become gay. But there's absolutely no evidence that child-rearing practices or that anything that parents do makes a child gay or makes a child gender dysphoric or transgender. So even if you were a parent who really wanted a girl and you had a boy, you're not going to be the cause of that child becoming transgender. It seems to be something biological, something we don't really understand why. And what I often tell people is the choice you have is not who you are, but how you live with who you are. And I think that that's quite important, because if you start believing that people can choose to not be gay, or that people can choose to not be dysphoric about or unhappy with their gender, then you can do a lot of damage in what are these so-called reparative therapies that are actually largely touted by the evangelical right in America, that are not just unhelpful, they're actively harmful to people.
They're unethical.
I'm
saying unethical.
Well, absolutely. In many places, they're actually not legal. And I think in South Africa, they really would be frowned upon by our Health Professions Council, because they actually actively do harm, what they call those reparative therapies that attempt to cure homosexuality.
So in other words, trying to say that homosexuality is a kind of a disease.
If you take that model, yes.
Sorry?
I'm saying that model, that it could be cured, assumes that there's a disease model that we're working with, but it's quite misinformed.
Absolutely, and that's a very dated idea. And an idea, of course, and we can't escape it, that our view of what's normal or acceptable is shaped by our culture. So Stan, when you talk about representation by Hollywood, it is an important thing to think about. But for like millennia, a lot of the ways that people who were gay or transgender were treated was also shaped by those societies, and often in very cruel and unaccepting ways.
Not that long ago, in Shakespeare's plays, women would only be represented by men. So I think we've come a long way in certain areas. We've still got a long way to go.
Legal and unethical, but in days gone by, being homosexual or gay in any way was punishable.
Absolutely. It's an offense. And what's alarming is that there are still countries in the world where you can go to jail. And I see the work actually of the evangelical Christian right from America in places like Uganda and Kenya, where they're trying to bring back the death sentence for homosexuality. And it alarms me, because it's such a terrible breach of human rights and of human choice and human freedom. But I think that there's a lot of also misunderstandings about a lot of the terms. So if you're interested, I mean, I can just talk through some of the terms, because people do get very confused.
Yes, that's important.
Okay. So I said that gender is... Well, a lot of the kids will tell you, because they have kids are already smart. They say sexual orientation is who you want to go to bed with, and your gender identity is who you go to bed as. But in gender identity, there are two terms which I, when I talk about it, I remind those of us old enough to remember Bob Dylan and the apartheid government, that there are two terms called transgender and cisgender. And transgender, literally like the trans sky, means the other side. So the Kai River would separate the Eastern Cape into the trans sky, which was the other side of the Kai River, and the cis sky, which was the same side, the side near East London. And the same with transgender means that your sense of yourself is the opposite of what you were assigned at birth, or what your biology or your physiology tells you you are. And cisgender is a term that you'll see people whose biology matches their sense of themselves. So the vast majority of people are cisgender. The other term that you'll see a lot, especially with teens and young adults, is the notion of gender fluid or gender non-binary, or even the notion of gender queer. Now, queer was a word that was used in the bad days, a derogatory term for gay people. But it's been really widely reclaimed as a term to describe people who say, we don't just fit in to the binary, to what's obvious. And that's a term that's often used as an umbrella term for a range of people and expressions that are not necessarily mainstream. And people who are gender fluid do not necessarily want to become someone of the opposite gender. They don't want to change their gender, but they don't feel that they are necessarily clearly one gender or the other. We used to sometimes talk about that as androgyny or being androgynous. And there's some quite well-known actors. There's Asia Kate Dillon, who's an actor on Billions and Orange is the New Black. And
she talks about herself as us. She doesn't refer to us as he or she, it's us.
Well, that's the whole issue of pronouns. So often trans people, so some trans people feel very strongly they were assigned female at birth and they want to become a man. The other issue just also to remember that we call that gender dysphoria, like an unhappiness with your gender. And the treatment for that is you can't cure that by therapy, but what you can do is help people understand the choices they have and the implications of those choices. So when I was growing up, I remember thinking, well, if you were transgender, you wanted to have lots of surgeries. You wanted to change your body and you wanted to maybe have various types of surgeries in addition to hormonal treatments. But more and more people are making choices not necessarily to have those surgeries because many of them are quite mutilating. But there's a range of how people adapt. But hormonal treatments are often quite a core component of people who are transitioning, or they call it now gender alignment surgeries or gender alignment treatments. They may or may not be surgical. And then, of course, people's pronouns change. So the famous example is Caitlyn Jenner. So Caitlyn Jenner was born Bruce Jenner, and there's a term in the trans community where if you use somebody's name from before their transition, it's called dead naming them because you're using a name that they no longer identify with. But as Bruce Jenner, Caitlin was an Olympic decathlete, a gold medal winner. And in her 60s, because she is now a woman, that's how she's identified. She's changed her identity documents. So she doesn't feel gender fluid. She is a trans woman. But there are many people who are much more in that murky space, and that's often where we use the pronouns they or theirs, the singular they. And my mother is an English teacher, and I think she finds it very difficult to get used to the idea that they or theirs can be a singular. But what I've said is that we are a culture and a species that have got people to the moon, and we are a very, very clever race. And I think that we can get used to the singular they or theirs. And I think it's respectful if somebody says, you know, I don't like the name Judith, I'd like you to call me Judy. I think it's respectful to call them Judy. And I don't have an issue. And sometimes we slip up with pronouns. And I think that if your intention is to be respectful to somebody's wishes, that's okay if you slip up and you apologize. But that's an issue about a lot of people get perplexed about the pronouns.
Bob Dylan also said, we started with a song, but Bob Dylan said also that people will love you if you fit into their box.
Exactly. Well, they do. I mean, it's easier when people are like us. There is such a lot of in and out group stuff. And I think also people get confused with another term, which is the transvestite or the drag queen or drag king even. And transvestitism is literally wearing the vestments or clothes of the other gender, the trans word. And the majority of transvestites or drag queens, and RuPaul is a very famous drag queen, are actually, the majority are men, although you do get women who dress as men, and those are called drag kings. But usually that's for entertainment, self-expression, as a form of sort of artistic endeavor. And it's, I mean, if anyone's watched RuPaul's Drag Race, it's a hugely flamboyant and quite fascinating world with its own subculture, with its own slang and language. And that's often associated with gay men, drag queens. But that's not about gender dysphoria. The majority of transvestites or drag queens do not necessarily want to be women. And there is another group of transvestites where we call them, it's a transvestic fetish. And that's a whole separate issue. And that's about sexual desire. And those are people who get some kind of sexual pleasure from wearing the underwear or the clothes of the other gender. And that's often actually the majority of people who do this for sexual pleasure are straight men, often married men. And that's why it's confusing, because it kind of really merges the issues of gender expression, sexual orientation, and sexual behaviors. And the sexual behaviors, we call them the paraphilias. those are like your sexual fetishes, and there are many, 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 many. I'm not sure if this is the right forum to talk about them, but they're really fascinating because they are very hard to change for people, but they are not related to your sexual orientation or to your gender expression. It's a whole different area.
Mm-hmm. So what is the, I don't know if this is an answerable question, but is the, what is the prevalence of all of this? Is it growing? Is it something which has been there, has just surfaced? Where are we with all of this? I mean, the schools are now suggesting that you can wear what you want, or you'll come, everybody will just come in pants, or just now maybe everybody will just come in skirts. Where are we going? I mean, what's the future of this?
So the epidemiological prevalence is hard always to pinpoint because, as Alfred Kinsey said, what people say they do and what they really do is often different. But what we do see is a rise of this in kids. And when kids sort of express an interest in or tell their parents in some ways that they feel different to what their parents expect, the most important thing is not to rush to action or judgment. But I do see that schools are trying very hard, actually, to be accommodating and non-stigmatizing and non-pathologizing. So many of the schools, and it's, of course, much easier in a co-ed school. It's a real challenge in a single-sex school. I've done talks in some of the, like, the girls-only schools, and they've had some girls who've said they identify as boys, they want to transition. And then the girls, the schools are saying, we really want to support these kids, but we are a girls' school. But the co-ed schools, what I see is some of the schools are doing, for example, some of the local government schools have made decisions that rather than having what they call a boy's uniform, which is pants, and a girl's uniform, which is a skirt, is there's set one and set two. And you can wear whatever you like from set one or set two. And I think that's quite a way of avoiding a really unnecessary source of stress for kids who feel uncomfortable, like girls who feel uncomfortable wearing dresses. That does really manage that distress. And I see also many schools are having gender-neutral bathrooms. And I really think, having worked at a primary school as a psychologist, I think that all the worst things that happen in schools happen in bathrooms, from clogging up of toilets to bullying. And I really think it's a time where we worked on how we make all the bathrooms safer and more sanitary. But I think that gender-neutral bathrooms where kids have privacy in the bathroom is a really good way to go.
What age group are we talking? Are we talking primary, high school?
Throughout.
Well, you start, yeah. I mean, Natalie, you're right. That when I do talks at nursery school about sexuality, and I always have teachers and parents come and say, my 3-year-old, my 4-year-old, my 5-year-old is doing this, won't wear skirts, says they want to be a boy, says they want to be a girl. Some of those kids, there's no question, are not going to be transgender. They're going to, and some of them, it doesn't mean that they're gay. There's such a variety of reasons why children may say those kinds of things. But it's very important if, as a parent, you're hearing those kind of things, that you don't just try and pretend that it's not happening, but also that you don't, again, jump to conclusion, but rather speak to your child's teacher, get expert advice about how to deal with it. But certainly what we see is kids around pre-teens who are saying very clearly that since they were little, they felt like they weren't in the right body. The best practice in the medical community is to offer counseling around choices, not counseling to try and cure or change. But I think counseling to really help those kids and their parents understand the journey that's ahead, because it's not an easy journey. But the best practice now is that those kids will be referred to an endocrinologist and various other medical professionals. And the treatment for preteens is to delay puberty. They give them hormones that are puberty blockers. They don't irreversibly stop it, but they allow the kid more time to explore what it is they really want. Because once children have gone into puberty biologically, those secondary sexual characteristics, so for boys, getting an Adam's apple, a deep voice, you know, large feet, large hands, for girls starting to menstruate, having breasts. Those are very, very hard to undo. And often that there's a lot of distress around that. So the best practice is to just delay puberty so that the kid has more time and the family has more time to think about and explore the options.
How long would the delay be? What would be kind of best practice? Does what and delay it in? Well, yeah. How long can one delay it for?
That's a few years. So that you would hopefully by the time the kid is around 15, 16, that they've had enough support and thinking about it. Again, you don't want to rush into treatments. Mm. You don't want to rush into hormones, but you also don't want to delay it so that the kid then is faced with a really difficult life of, you know, being like, I mean, if you look at Caitlyn Jenner, who's had the best feminizing surgery money can buy, but you know, Caitlyn Jenner is still a 6'4" woman with huge hands and an Adam's apple.
What is your What is your sense of gender neutral child rearing? What is your thoughts about that?
Well, I'd love to see it in practice. I think it's really hard. And I mean, I'm really believe that we shouldn't stereotype our children. We should be chilled. I think it's lovely if boys want to play with the dolls because it teaches them how to be good caregivers. And I'm sure they grow up to be awesome dads if they play with dolls. And, I think that boys should be encouraged to cook and girls should be encouraged to be brave and to take things apart and to climb things. But I think it's really hard to go to this like extreme version of, there was I think quite an eccentric Canadian couple who decided with their third child, they were not going to tell the world what that child's gender was. They were going to call the child X. And I thought that was, I don't know how you do it. I've really thought carefully. And that's why for those parents whose children are born biologically indeterminate, with a disorder of sexual differentiation, I think it's one of the most difficult things. And those parents need a lot of support and compassion because, in a way, there have been some tragic instances where, for example, choices have been made because it's medically easier to do something. So, and some of those kids that have been born with sort of disorders of sexual differentiation, there used to be a saying it's easier to make a hole than a pole. So all those children were just made into girls medically and given female hormones, but they were boys because it's not your sexual organs that make you a boy or your girl. I did a talk at one of the schools and I said very clearly, you are more than what's in your pants. I mean, that's not the most interesting thing about any person. It should be not the thing. That's why we shouldn't be preoccupied with what people who are a gender non-conforming or do have in their underwear. Mm. But if you have a child who is has a disorder of sexual differentiation, and we saw some of this very interesting with some tragic cases of there was a little boy who was kidnapped. It would have been in the 80s and found near Barra. It was a 2-year-old boy and he'd been mutilated for muti, they think, and he'd had his penis amputated. And that little boy at that time, they thought, well, they'll make him a girl. Mm. And they gave him hormones. Mm. It was a disaster. And we've seen that there was a case of identical boy twins in Canada where one had a botched circumcision and a decision was made. This is many decades ago. To raise that boy as a girl. And again, what they ended up was with an incredibly depressed person who never felt right in their own body because it's not just a bisexual organ. So when you have those children and you don't know what gender they are, to raise in a gender neutral way is really challenging, but it means being very thoughtful and being quite careful not to stereotype your child's behavior and not to put so much pressure on your child to only play like a boy or play like a girl. Sorry, it was a very long answer to your question, Matthew.
No, that's 100%. The when you talk about kids at school and obviously, you know, different people will stand out differently, especially when it comes to high school. So that's when things are really, to use a different term, starting to take shape. But the stigma, you know, are people excluded for various reasons? Is this where it begins really to be serious mentally?
So I think that the stigma comes in the broader society, often in the more conservative areas of the community. In the schools that I've done work with, and obviously the fact that those schools have invited me in to do this kind of talk means that they are open to thinking about it. And generally in those schools, what the teachers have said to me is that the kids are generally much more accepting than they used to be. There's much less homophobia or bullying around sexual orientation in those schools where there are safe spaces to talk about difference. And in fact, the majority of stigma or difficulty comes from the outside community, from parents and from conservative corners of the community and of the world. And that is hard. That's a challenge because in many faith systems, being gay and being transgender is not something that sits easily with some mainstream religions. So there are challenges that need to be dealt with. But what I find is in schools where there's where teachers are open to allowing kids to talk about difference and diversity in the broader sense, whether it's difference around race or around class, around money, around opinions, around views on politics, then those kids who are different in those schools feel much safer. But again, if you don't feel safe in your own home, that's really probably where the greatest problem lies. And that's why I think parents have to be advocates and guardians of their children's well-being psychologically.
So we're talking to Judith Ansah. She's a clinical psychologist in practice in Johannesburg. We have in the studio Natalie Solomon, Dr. Natalie Solomon, also a clinical psychologist. And we're talking about gender. Judith, just at the end of the day, I mean, we're coming to the end of the program, but at the end of the day, what's the procedure your child, you have this potential problem on your hands, the child is displaying various different activities to what you're expecting or what you would expect. What's the step? What does one do? I mean, is it easy to deal with? Are there places to go? Can one get the right advice? Or is it something which they would prefer not to talk about and just, you know, sweep it under the carpet and hope it goes away?
Yeah, I think the worst thing you can do is pretend it's not happening and try and sweep it under the carpet. Maybe the worst thing is when you try very hard to change it without any understanding of what you're doing. But I think the best thing parents can do is create spaces to talk. So if you notice that your child hates wearing dresses, you can say to your child, you can just comment, I see you don't like wearing dresses. What is it? Because you also must be careful of making assumptions. They might not like dresses because they have sensory issues and they don't like the way the skirt feels on their legs. But if they're saying, I don't want to be a girl, I think I'm a boy, rather than telling them they're wrong or they shouldn't do it, you can say, I really want you to tell me more about it. I want to try and understand where you're coming from. That's the most important thing, is to be able to hear your children and not criticize them or contradict them. Because it's one of the things that children will say, you know, I want to be a girl, says a little boy. And the parents say, don't say that. That's wrong. Don't be ridiculous. And then the child gets the message, I'm not okay. So open up conversations and be curious. There are fantastic resources available. I think most psychologists, social workers in our communities are thoughtful about these issues now. There's a greater understanding. There's even for teenagers, if your teenagers are struggling, there's even a Jewish-based Facebook. I don't have the site on me. I've got to find it. Sorry, I can always email you if you need to, it's a resource people want. But there's a thing, I think it's called Safe Spaces Johannesburg, which is a kind of anonymous space where people can, there's a Facebook page and a website where people can, kids and parents can ask for support, can get information, can just find a safe space to ask the difficult questions. And I think those are great resources. There's a lot of material available. I always think that you must be careful on the internet if you don't go to quite mainstream sites. If you be careful that you might be getting your information from maybe like very, very conservative places and then know that's where that's coming from. But I do think that I think most of the mental health professionals working in Johannesburg today are quite thoughtful about this issue. Maybe Natalie, I don't know if you'd agree.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I think schools are also very supportive in the main, those sort of mainstream schools. And I hope that this kind of conversation is something that schools will take seriously and really open that space up for kids.
Is there a responsibility at school level to highlight this type of activity or this type of behavior?
Well, I think there's a responsibility for teachers or for schools to be open to discussing difference. And some of that is about having literature and whether it's even in the curriculum. I did a talk at one of the girls' schools, not at one of the Jewish schools, and they were talking about how they look at issues of race and diversity, even within the curriculum, but even in the biology curriculum, for example, they will look at the issue. It came up actually in the IB biology exam a few years ago, is like the ethical issues around gender or the biological issues or the debates around gender. So there's curricular stuff that can happen. And also there are the ways teachers can talk is not to shame people who are different, to be respectful. And that's also with adults, with parents, not to shame people. And I think all schools should never tolerate bullying. Any bullying around difference is unacceptable, whether it's bullying about gender or that a boy is effeminate or a girl is a tomboy, or if it's bullying about a child who's overweight or a child who's short. No bullying is ever acceptable, and schools need to work hard to make themselves also those sort of safe spaces for children.
So we've been talking
and
to...
No, it's just schools can create spaces where they invite parents in and get in experts to talk about issues around difference. And the parents are the ones who are the most worried often. And I think if schools can provide those for parents to come in, that's also a great thing that schools can do.
So we've been talking to Judith Anser. She's, as I said, a clinical psychologist. We had Natalie Solomon in the studio. She's a doctor, clinical psychologist as well. And Judith, in the last few minutes, unfortunately, this hour is the end of these programs seems to come almost as we start. So maybe there's another million questions. But in the last few minutes available, would you like to just tell us about yourself? What you do, if you want to be contacted, don't give your home number out on this show, but just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'll tell you that I'm a clinical psychologist, and so is my sister Ruth, and we are two different people. My sister also does a lot of talks. I'm saying this because she's going to listen to the podcast. She couldn't listen live, so I want to give a shout out to my sister, who's also does actually a lot more media than I do. So my practice is largely I work with adults and parents. I don't work with kids directly anymore. I used to have worked at Crossroads and I've worked at Tara Hospital with adults. But my interest is really in helping people feel that they have the courage to talk about difficult things with the people they love and to be able to hear difficult things without judgment and without shaming. I'm really looking forward to the December break. Can I say that as well?
You can, as are we all. And we started out by saying that don't make the mistake of, what you can't understand. Don't criticize what you can't understand. I hope we've clarified a few issues. I think thank you, Judith, for coming on, for spending some time with us, for talking about subjects which I suppose in families are touchy. I think sometimes if you speak about it, maybe that does help in society, and maybe we've done a little bit of good tonight.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening, and have a good Shabbos and good night from the Hebrew Order of David.